Hello, everybody. It's Brie Bagwell with your Only Vans podcast recap. And this week, I'm so excited. We have Ismay, which is an alternative folk music project driven by California-based singer-songwriter Avery Hellman. And Avery really does it all. Curates a music festival called Woolly Star, releases amazing records. Please go listen to Ismay's Desert Pavement LP right now. And is currently working on a project documenting the early musical footsteps of Americana icon Lucinda Williams. We dive into that project immediately and bring up Charlie Sexton, an amazing producer who was in Bob Dylan's band and co-founded the Archangels. The Finding Lucinda podcast they recorded on this journey is out now everywhere you listen and is presented by our same amazing podcast network, The Bluegrass Situation. Growing up on a farm in Sonoma County, California, with a grandfather who founded the Harley Strictly Bluegrass Festival, Ismay is an incredible product of that farm and musical lifestyle, and you are going to flip when we talk about Avery's phone. We were instant friends. Enjoy.
One of the two venues that's left that Lucinda played early on.
Wow.
It was fun.
I did not know that she played there.
Yeah, she has a funny story about how she kind of was playing around and playing hole in the wall. She was playing this place called Rome Inn. She was playing Alamo Lounge, I think it was called. All these kinds of places. And she had booked a gig at Hole in the Wall. And this is back in the day. And this is her story, but I'm going to share it anyways. And she had this story about how she was like, hey, man, what happened? I had this date on the calendar. And the booker was like, oh, we already had too many chick singers this month, so we took you off.
That's amazing.
It's just so funny. And this is the 70s, you know, but
yeah.
Hey, everybody. This is Brie Bagwell, and this is my podcast, Only Vans, where I talk to my friends in my van.
Test.
One, two, three, four, five. And
six,
I'm
seven.
So, this is whiskey. I'm super sorry. I assumed that I knew.
I love you already. You're
I
an
knew
angel.
That you were a dog. I was like, she's a fun dog. That's my baby. And your environmental stuff made me just want to explode with pride because we try our best on the road, but I had just emptied out. We put all the water bottles in the shower. Mm. The shower is for the water bottles.
Yeah.
But it makes me crazy to be on the road, the amount of waste that we see.
It's hard to keep it in check, I'll say that. I understand that.
And I just think if we all just do the best that we can, it would go a long ways. But when I see somebody not doing the best that they can, it makes me...
Well, especially when people start throwing trash around on the outside, that's really bad, too.
Don't mess with Texas. We got a whole campaign about it.
Oh, nice.
Avery, it's so nice to meet you. Thank you for coming here.
Yeah, of course.
And you are in the middle of I don't even know how much we can or can't talk about.
Well, yeah, we can talk about it a little bit, you know.
Yeah, a little teaser. And we can wait to put this out if we need to. But Kate was sending me all these bullet points. And she kept saying, well, I don't know if you can talk about this, but listen to what is happening. And then, I don't know if you can talk about this, but this is also happening. Like, oh, my gosh. The most exciting group of bullet points I've seen in a long time. Holy cow. And if we can start with the Charlie Sexton thing, because...
Sure.
He's Austin music royalty, and what an amazing producer and person. So are you working on some sort of record?
So basically, I got connected with Charlie. There's a guy named Chuck Prophet who's a Bay Area guy, and he plays a lot in Austin, actually. And he was working on this film project, this Finding Lucinda film project, and he's like, you should really meet my friend Charlie. This guy has a great connection with Lucinda. And then we
just throws it out there. This guy, Charlie.
just no big deal. But yeah. I didn't know a ton about him or anything. But what I found out is that Charlie played with Lucinda when he was 11 or 12, which is insane. And she was about 25 at the time, I figured out. And so it was one of the first times he was playing, first year he was playing out as a kid, basically, and she was just first starting to play out. And so we decided to interview him for the film and get connected with that and just hear about his first impressions of Lucinda back then, because he's one of the longest relationships Lucinda Williams has had with any musician, I think, ongoing. And So then I was have been kind of working on the soundtrack, trying to put out some tracks with the film, alongside the film, that are trying to get into Lucinda's history, her contribution to songwriting, the influences she had. And so I had this idea. I could hear, there's this recording of Lucinda. Sorry, I'm like totally bombarding you with information.
No, I love it. And I'm glad that you said Lucinda Williams too, because I'm on a first name basis with her as a fan.
Oh, yeah.
I've never met her. Just
she'd like you a
she
lot.
She doesn't need, she just needs one first name for me. She's a Cher moment, or like a Shania, you know?
Right. Yeah. That's so good. I like that. Okay, good, because you guys are the real deal. I can tell you, just Lucinda.
Yeah.
So she did this recording at KUTFM in the early 80s. It's awesome recording. It's sort of like not really released, but you can kind of find it in the corners of the internet. And she did this recording, and I heard, I was like, wow, like, there's this Tejano Tex-Mex influence. What is this? Where did this come from? And then I learned more about Flaco Jimenez and sort of the history of all that music. I fell in love with that style of music. And then I was like, well, how do I, like, do a recording that's referencing this style of music that was a big part of her influence, and then record some of her songs in that style? So that's kind of what I've been working on with Charlie, and yeah.
Wow. That is Flaco going to be a part of it?
Oh my gosh. It's going to be, so I've been working with the Tex Maniacs.
Yes.
San Antonio folks that have been doing it with me.
Yes.
So that'll be fun. And then also the cool thing is that we're doing it at the Cactus Cafe. So it's kind of like a recreation of supposedly the actual events that happened in the 81. So like Lucinda recorded on KUT. Probably in the Cactus Cafe back then. So it's kind of a thing. Yeah.
I love that. But how did that even come about? Are you just, you were just a curious fan turned friend, or you, because of the festival, you met her at a young age? I did not look up that part or ask, because I thought it would be a real life ask. And
ooh, IRL ask. Yeah. I like that. So yeah, I mean, so the way I got into it is I listened to her when I was a kid. I didn't know her or anything. I saw her perform, and my dad and I formed a Lucinda Williams tribute band. So we used to play like the 3-hour bar gigs, you know, with a band singing only Lucinda songs. And then we were going to make a record, and I was like, I don't really want to make a record. I love her records. Let's just do something else. I was like, let's do a little documentary project thing. And so then we kind of, it grew over years. I mean, it's been 6 years of working on it. And so it's just grown over that time period. And then we kind of like sent them a little note, like, we're working on this, you know. It wasn't in conjunction with them or anything. It was just sort of like a love letter to Lucinda through this story of being a songwriter, just looking towards her as a hero. So yeah.
Oh my gosh, what an honor for her, because you are so talented. I was listening to your records. I drove straight here from Nashville, so
oh my god,
I did take a break and sleep in East Texas somewhere last night, but I was a little bit kind of frazzled running into Austin today, trying to get gas in a 32-foot RV in downtown Austin. Listen, wouldn't recommend. A little bit. The box wine was staring at me, but it's too early. But I almost had to, because it was so stressful getting here. But I was listening to your records, and the last one, Desert Pavement, was 2024, right? So that was last year. Mm-hmm. It's still a baby.
That's a good way to describe it, because as you know, when you put out records, you're like, it feels like it's been out forever and ever because it takes so long, but it's a baby record, I guess.
It's a baby record. Well, and everyone's like, okay, well, when's the next one? I just did this one. Can you let it have its moment for a second? But I love the name, of course, because I'm from New Mexico. I'm a desert girl. I'm obsessed.
Right.
And so as soon as I saw the cover and the title, I'm like, I'm going to love this. And I do. But the sounds on that record, there are so many. It kind of gave me a Patty Griffin feel, but more of like the alluding to the title. But it has a lot of kind of ethereal, magical sounds throughout it. It's very fun to drive to.
Oh, good. That's a good thing to hear. I mean, New Mexico. I read about that in your bio, and New Mexico's where my heart is. I gotta say, I lived there for like
where
on and off for a year. Las Vegas.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Real small town. And don't be confused, audience members, it's not Las Vegas, Nevada. I even met this guy. I was at this conference, Folk Alliance conference, and I met this great songwriter, Max Gomez. He's amazing, from New Mexico.
Okay, I know that name.
He's really great. He's very like folk classic John Prine kind of style.
Cool.
And he lives in LA now, but I met him, and I was like, yeah, I lived in New Mexico and Las Vegas. He was like, wait, what? Confusing.
It is. It's a smaller town, but there's a college there. But I love that square and that old hotel that is on the square. I've stayed there a couple of times.
Really?
It is haunted.
I believe it.
It's cute there. So and there was cute. A great restaurant there. I guess I was just more surprised at how much I liked Las Vegas. It's about 5 hours north of where I'm from. So I'm from the polar opposite. I'm like super, super, super south. Mm. So it's when people, I mean, you know this being from California, but when people, oh, I know someone that lives in New Mexico, and you're like, that's 5.5 hours from where I live. It's not a small geographical place. That's so interesting. Why did you live there?
I was just hanging out with some friends, kind of like aimless, you know, living at somebody's grandma's house.
Great.
And she had a great spot out there. And I loved it. I mean, New Mexico, I think it's a whole nother universe from California. Like, California is varied, you know, there's a lot, we got a lot going on there, but New Mexico has this energy and look to it that I just didn't even know existed in the universe.
Yeah, well, we like to keep it a secret. Okay. So not everybody moves there, but I tell people all the time, so it's fine. They, especially on this podcast, they definitely know. But I really do, the few times in my life where I was thinking, I need to throw in the towel, or I need some sort of sign from the universe or whatever. And I remember being in Taos in a hot spring and just being, feeling like the world was giving me an actual hug and telling me I was going to be okay. Mm. And it's a magical place, but it has been magical throughout history. So it's definitely has healing powers and some spiritual powers. And if you don't believe that, don't tell me, because that's what I believe. But I'm glad you love it.
I buy it 100%. And I remember when I was out there, I think the only concert that was going on during the time was Lucinda Williams was playing in Taos at the Taos Mesa Brewing Company or something. So this was like 10 or 12 years ago.
Of course. It is, see, magical once again. And then maybe she sprinkled that idea into your brain and you were like, oh, and then now you're it. I don't know.
I'm just doing it.
You're doing it. I'm playing a festival there in August. And I already told my agent, just don't book me anything before or after that. I'm going to just get there early, stay late. My boyfriend, his grandfather bought a house in Santa Fe in the 50s. Mm. And so, and it's like right off the square, and it's a magical pueblo, beautiful place. So it's like, as soon as we're soulmates, obviously. So we go to Santa Fe, and I love Santa Fe and Las Cruces. But you are from Sonoma, wait.
So I'm originally from the Bay Area.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I lived for about 10 years in Sonoma County, which is sort of like the farthest extent of the Bay Area. You know, it's kind of dairy and then wine country, but it's some dairies that are rebranding as vineyards.
Right. I was going to say, because you were talking about being from a farm and ranch family. I was like, oh, are you farming and ranching any grapes out there?
Our place is too much clay for all that. But we have, you know, horses and cows and all that. And the thing that they do that's funny out there is like, well, it's Sonoma County, so you get to slap the name on the grapes. I don't know if they're any good, but
right,
maybe.
That's so funny. Oh, must be from Sonoma County.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
exactly.
So interesting. Do you know how to shear sheep?
I do. I can't do it like myself. It actually takes a lot of training to do it and a lot of physical capability. It's this very specific thing that you have to learn. You have to go do a training with a shear. I mean, you could cut like, you know, the way you could trim your own doggy's fur, you could try, but really you have to know how to do it. And so I haven't done the whole dealio, but I've assisted.
Okay, great. Well, because it's in your songs and I was like, I have to ask.
So wait, in New Mexico, were you around ranching and farming stuff at all?
Yes, a lot. And I listened to another one of your interviews today, and I'm like, oh my gosh, we have so much in common, because I was a farming and ranch family girl that just picked up a guitar instead of the reins, and it was fine. Like, it doesn't seem like your family was really, like, you must be this person. And mine was kind of like, go play guitar and move to Austin. Great. Like, it was just... And they all kind of play and sing, not as much professionally, but everyone kind of has this musical fiber, but it's just, they are proud of me for doing it.
So wait, have you ever heard of the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering?
Yes.
Have you ever played there?
No.
They would die to have you.
I don't know about
yes,
that.
Yes, they would, because you have this real history and wonderful music. And they love, like, people who are like, I come from a ranching family and I play music as, like, the best. They would just die for
where
your
is
stuff.
It in Arizona or somewhere else?
It's in the middle of Nevada.
Nevada.
So it's kind of, you know, I don't know. It's kind of a strange thing, but it's really cool.
Yeah.
And it's, like, a really cool historical kind of community thing. I'm really into it. It's not everybody's bag, but I love it.
It would be my bag. Can I go with you?
Yeah, that'd be great.
My cousin was the Western Artist of the Year a while ago, but she's the reason that I wanted to be a singer, my cousin Kip Callahan, and she would go to all the cowboy poetry gatherings, and she would sing, and she could yodel, and she was amazing. She still sings and stuff, but I don't think that people really can get cowboy poetry until they experience it. It's something it's hard for me to explain. Maybe you'll do better than me, but I always say there's one time I was around a campfire at a trail ride, and I was the artist that they'd hired to play, but I was just sitting around. All the people at the trail ride had gone to bed, and it was just me and the ranch hands and a guy that does a lot of cowboy poetry, and he was talking. He did one about a good horse, and we were all me and all these cowboys just like boo-hooing around a campfire. It's a delivery, but it's brilliant stuff, and the memorization and the, I don't know, it's beautiful.
It is really cool. And the cool thing about the cowboy poetry gathering is that it's sort of like you have the traditional cowboy poetry, which is like this type of poetry that came about from ranching work. That's sort of a specific tradition. But then you have like other poets who write about life in like the rural West, whether they grew up there or it's sort of something they chose. People who come from ranching backgrounds write poetry that's more sort of like a modern style poetry. And then you have music that's like the traditional super cowboy westerny sort of like something you kind of classic that you'd picture. But then there's also sort of people who are bringing a new spin on it. So it's like it's most cowboy poetry gatherings, I think, are focused on the tradition, which is cool. But the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering sort of has the different elements, which is what inspires me, because it's like a folk tradition matching with new types of art, which I love.
OK, I would love to see that. Love to see that.
They would be so excited because they love people who have that connection to horses, like you said. You just mentioned, like, you listen to that story, and it's like, me too. It's like, you hear a story about a good horse, you're just crying. It's so funny. It's like, gets right to your heart. But it's such a cool thing. And then they have this place there in Elko that's called the Western Folklife Center. And they show all this Western crafts and paintings, and they'll show like a masterfully made saddle. And then you can look at it in the gallery, the art gallery there. It's super cool.
Oh my gosh. Well, I love that. Do you know what time of year it is? I'm like asking all these questions I could definitely ask off camera. But.
No. It's for everybody out there. It's the last week of January, first week of February.
Wow. Yeah. That's so fun. Maybe they'll sponsor this podcast now. No, I'm just
That'd
kidding.
That'd be great. You never know.
Free tickets for us. No, I'm just kidding. Happy to go support. And I know that my boyfriend's band plays. I think it's in that same city. Somebody puts on these house concerts and stuff there too. So maybe we can make it a whole thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to your music. Was your first record 2020?
My first record. So I put out an EP in like 2018, and then, but I don't know if it's still out there anymore, really. But my first full record was, 2020, March 6th, 2020.
The best time in history to ever start a new project.
But you want to know what's funny about it? Is I was sort of in like, you know, as you know, and you've mentioned, we go through high points and low points in music and art. And I was sort of at this low point where I had lost my motivation to book shows. I was doing it, but I was like a little in that scared phase that you get about booking shows. And I was like, whatever, I'm just going to half-ass it. And so I did, and I didn't have very many album release shows because I just hadn't had the energy to do it. And then the pandemic came, I was like, well, if I had done a good job, it all would have been for nothing.
It would have been a waste anyway.
It would have been a waste, so I win.
That is awesome. I mean, nobody could have seen it. I was going to, my first shows that canceled were in Australia.
Oh, wow.
And then I had two shows in Vegas randomly for something, and so my first two were just giant cool shows, and then after that I think it was my whoever was doing my booking at the time was they were doing too good of a job and they were probably really mad. But I think I canceled like 172 shows or something by the time it was all done.
Oh my God, that's crazy.
It was crazy. It was too many. And now we're all, I was just talking to Bart Crow before you about how we're trying to make more money and play less anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That's the plan.
Yeah.
So nobody needs that to the grind anymore. I don't know really what works in music anymore, but I don't think that killing yourselves booking shows is, that's just so, that makes me cringe. That's like the most hard thing to do in the whole world.
That's true.
Let's do less of it.
Yeah. No more squeezing ourselves dry like a lemon from Whole Foods. We got to keep some juice inside, you know?
That's right. And that's recording and doing projects that fulfill us, like a documentary. Mm-hmm. So, like, when... it says it's following the early career of Lucinda. Can you dive more into that?
Absolutely. So, yeah, the story is about sort of, like, being a songwriter, looking for what's my path forward. You know, especially when you're starting out and you're not sure if you should believe in yourself. It's a lot about self-doubt and not being sure of where to go. And so in the story, it's about taking a road trip to look towards Lucinda Williams' early career and her early life and what did she do and what can I learn from her story. And so I went to Austin first. I went to, there's a library at the University of Texas here that has all of these archives from her father's life, because he was a well-known, celebrated poet, so letters and photographs were saved from his life. And then we went and spoke with Charlie Sexton and interviewed him at Hole in the Wall, one of the two venues that's left that Lucinda played early on.
Wow.
It was fun.
I did not know that she played there.
Yeah, she has a funny story about how she kind of was playing around and playing Hole in the Wall. She was playing this place called Rome Inn. She was playing Alamo Lounge, I think it was called, all these kinds of places. And she had booked a gig at Hole in the Wall, and this is back in the day, and this is her story, but I'm going to share it anyways. And she had this story about how she was like, hey, man, what happened? I had this date on the calendar. And the booker was like, oh, we already had too many chick singers this month, so we took you off.
That's amazing.
It's just so funny. And this is the 70s, you know, but...
Yeah.
Hey, this is Bree Bagwell, and if you want to listen to this podcast early and ad-free, subscribe to my Patreon at www.patreon.com/BreeBagwell.
Howdy, y'all. It's Bree Bagwell, and I know y'all support the people who support me, so let me tell you about Deep Ellum Brewing Company. Born and raised in Deep Ellum, Texas, Deep Ellum Brewing Company has really made its mark on the beer world. Known for its flagships, Dallas Blonde and Deep Ellum IPA, they put boring beers to shame with a full lineup that's unapologetically not brewed to style. My personal favorite is the Dallas Blonde. It is so easy to drink. I just took it home for the holidays and my whole family was like obsessed with this beer. No joke. They drank it all. Thanks a lot, family. So head over to deepellumbrewing.com to open the beer vault and give your fridge what it deserves. And you'll see why love runs deep for Deep Ellum Brewing Company. Available in Texas and Oklahoma, side effects may include severe happiness. Deep Ellum Brewing Company products are for individuals 21 and older, and we encourage drinking responsibly. Are you ready to take your merchandise to the next level? Well, just ask me who I use, and that is CH Lone Star Promo. They specialize in screen printing and direct-to-garment, embroidery, laser engraving, anything promo-related, they can do it. Step up your merch game now with CH Lone Star Promo and tell them Brie and Whiskey sent you. Well, that's some of that still happens. Someone told my boyfriend the other day that he said, oh, you should have Brie here. And he said, oh, we don't book girls here. And I said, it's been a long time since I heard something of that sentiment, and I was... like, I thought we were past that. No, okay. Just every once in a while, there's a little reminder that we haven't completely moved on from it. And
that's crazy.
There's still work to be done.
Yeah. That is straight up crazy town.
I know. Small town somewhere. I don't know. I'm not going to call them out. I might have that wine and just straight up call them out on the pod. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, they're going to have it coming to them, karma or otherwise.
That's correct.
And also, Not Meg. Not booking girls. Give me a freaking break. What is this?
I know.
Handmaid's Tale.
Oh my gosh. I couldn't get through more than that show. I was sweating watching it. I was like, I only got through like 4 episodes.
I actually have never watched it. I just have it as my nice cultural reference, but.
It worked. I was very impressed. I was like, wow, she made it through more than 4 episodes. I only made it through. I couldn't do it. Anyway, what are you watching now? I'm curious.
Oh my gosh, I'm a huge TV person.
Okay.
Well, obviously White Lotus.
Yeah, I haven't yet.
Oh my gosh,
I'm waiting
until
I get back with my boyfriend because we're going to do that together. It is really good. Okay.
It's so good. It's some of the best storytelling I think in TV. And then I've been watching. I love this show, Love on the Spectrum. Been watching that on Netflix. It's
my favorite show.
I love it.
There's apparently a new season. I haven't.
That's
seen.
What I've been watching. Okay. Binge watching. And then my other favorite show, Severance.
Okay.
Do you know it?
No.
It's okay. Let me preface this. It's sort of sci-fi, but I don't actually like sci-fi personally. But this
either.
Show is transcends that.
Okay.
And it's good. It's about the story of people who would like to sever their working life from their out-of-work life, and so they insert a chip into their brain in order to make it so they have no memory connection between the two people. So essentially people are split into two people, and it's about the moral quandaries that come about from that. And it's super fascinating, and it's not like only sci-fi people like it, because again, I'll reiterate, I don't like sci-fi.
Right.
But I
okay,
love it.
I'm gonna give it a go.
It's amazing.
I don't even know my work and home, and now my boyfriend's a musician too, and has been for. So I don't even know how to separate anything anymore. My mm-hmm. cell phone is just—it's always just. Is it in a text? Is it in a group text? Is it in an email? Is it in a? I'm really trying to get off of social media more because mm-hmm. it's making me feel less than.
Yeah.
And find a way to create some boundaries with work. I don't know how to do it. I'm really struggling with that. Do you struggle with
anything? Oh my gosh, definitely. It's like an everyday thing. Social media especially. I mean, I started totally changing my relationship with it. It's been like this ongoing thing. And I have this friend, this wonderful songwriter, Margot Silker is her name. And we've been talking about it. And she's like, Avery, you sound like an AA like coach the way I talk about social media stuff that I work on. But I've been working on not going on there, not having it. I actually got a flip phone. That's really helped.
Yeah, I love this. Okay. You really did.
Yeah. You want to see it?
Boy, do I.
I get a lot of stares. But I met a guy.
No, this is the best thing ever. I stop it. I'm sorry, but where do you buy a coupon?
So you have to take a time machine to the 1980s.
Yeah, right,
no,
just kidding. Right.
I actually 1990s, but I got it on Verizon website, and they don't want you to get it because they can't make as much money. But I have a system where I have a flip phone, and it's ongoing. This is an ongoing system. I'm still working out, but I have a flip phone, and then I have an iPad, so that when I need to navigate or I need to work, I have my iPad. I just don't bring my iPad with me a lot of the time if I don't need navigation. And then I just got my flip phone. I just look at other people, and you wouldn't believe it. The world is full of fascinating things. I was on the plane. I had nothing to do, and so I was just looking at the sign for the bathroom on the plane, and even that is fascinating, and we need to detach our brains from this freaking phone, because like I was just making this joke to these people the other day. I'm like, so I was in upstate New York playing a gig, and I was like, man, people in this town aren't on their phones, yet when I'm in, you know, New York City, everybody's on their phone. They're in the most interesting place in the world, and they're on their phones all the time. That's just an interesting, like,
yeah.
I don't know. People, and it's not our fault. This is the thing. You shouldn't feel like it's a personal failing that you're hooked on your phone.
Oh, I take everything as a personal failure. That's how I exist in my whole life. Thank you for telling me that. I'm going to take that with me.
I have been told I could make a decent therapist.
Yeah, you're doing great. Let me tell you some other things that are wrong with me. And
cool.
No, I'm just kidding. It's not. We're conditioned as a society to be,
and
more so every day.
And I just think, like, they're very addictive devices. They help us deal with our stress, but the thing that I realized, and after reading a few books, is just that, like, they give you a replacement for in-person interactions that do not do what in-person interactions should be doing. So they give you this false sense of connection, yet it's something, the way it functions with us psychologically, it doesn't replace it with enough of like the soul of that, that it makes you unhappy. And so I have been happier since I've been off it. My life isn't perfect, but, and I also take one a day a week. If I'm at home, it's hard when you're on tour. It's not realistic when you're on tour, but when I'm at home, I take one day a week, no computer, no TV, no phone, anything.
No devices.
I mean, sometimes someone will call me on my flip phone, but then it's like, I get to talk to my friend and I'm not distracted, you know? I like it.
I found myself putting someone on speakerphone so I could answer my emails. It was not, that was the point where I'm like, oh no, I have a problem. I mean, in addition to the social media problem, and it knows me and it knows what I want and what I haven't gotten, and it shows me that frequently.
Yes.
These are all the people doing the things that you want to do that no one's asked you to do. And I'm like, why am I like that?
I know. And the funny thing about it is, if it were used in a very micro sense, it can inspire you to do a couple things. But the way that it works is it makes you feel like this image that I'm watching is getting me towards achieving it. But it's not. It's distracting you from achieving it. Like, you see, you know, I go on Pinterest, and that's kind of my addiction platform. But I see, oh, here's this person with an accordion sitting in a beautiful, you know, mud house in Spain. Wouldn't I want to do that? But it's like, instead of just doing that, it's convincing me that looking at a picture is getting me there, and it's not.
It is not. But we should definitely do it. Do you know how to play the accordion?
No.
Me
Do you?
Oh. No, but my boyfriend's lead singer of his band just was like, I'm going to play the accordion, and went and bought one, and he plays it now on stage. And I feel like I never even considered that as a possibility.
That's a great thought. I mean, and also like the Tejano Tex-Mex thing.
It's perfect for that, because that's what I love. I always joke that I thought I was Hispanic till I was a teenager. No one, like, I just was living on the, my next song is called Border Girl. I'm from the border. I love Mexican American culture. I identify so strongly with everything down there, the language, the food, the people. And so I started incorporating a little bit of Spanish into my stuff. And then it just kind of was a natural progression for me that I leaned harder and harder into. And I think it works because people have been doing that in Texas for a long time. And so it didn't really shock anybody here. They weren't like, I hate it. They were like, yeah, this is a big part of Texas music. And Los Tex Maniacs are so good. I'm so excited for you. That's like, a dream.
Yeah, I love that stuff too. And it's so cool to hear that you're incorporating that to your music too, because I think the intersection of like Tex-Mex and all that and country music and all that, it's some of the best music. It's so beautiful. And it's true. It's like the culture that you grew up in. It's the culture around here. I think I love personally, like, you know, if people are from cultures that are somewhat separate and then collaborate, it's some of the most interesting collaborations, because it brings like really different bases of a sound. My friend Chuck Prophet, who I was talking about earlier, because he was the one who connected with me, Charlie Sexton, and been working on this Lucinda documentary, he just put out a record that is with like a Tejano style, actually no, they're cumbia, sorry, a cumbia band.
Okay.
But he's just like a, you know, he's not from that background or anything, but he's kind of got his like rock and roll singer songwriter thing, and it's so cool and people are loving it, and it's just great music.
It's great music. I had a Norteña band call me and ask me to come sing on their project, and I was so excited. So I got there, and it was a song in English. I'm like, what the hell? That's, so they promised me a Spanish song next, but they were doing a crossover English album. And
really?
So,
wow.
But it was, they did all, I did, you're just too good to be, can't take my eyes off of you. And they did it like Norteña style.
That's great.
It was awesome. And it was so much fun. So I'm obviously joking. I would love, but I still really want to do that Spanish song.
That's great. I've always wanted to do that kind of a thing, and I'd like to learn more about it. I mean, it's like I come from more understanding like the bluegrass music tradition and maybe more like English based folk music kind of a thing. And so that whole realm is so fascinating. There's so many different styles within it. I think there's so much to learn in that.
Yeah, I totally hear that in your records. I love the melodies, and so dreamy, like really, truly great songwriter. And obviously you do have the bluegrass influence from your and your grandfather starting the Hardly Strictly. How many times do you say that fast and do it? And can you do it?
Hardly Strictly Bluegrass
Music Festival. Today I was like, I'm going to mess that up. So I might as well just mess it up the first time. But he started that festival. And again, a similarity. My mom was the... She ran our state fair, Southern New Mexico State Fair. She was the executive director, so she would book all the talent. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of around all music at a young age, too, around stars. Not Alison Krauss, like I think you said on the interview. I was like, oh, my gosh, I would have died. But just being around, you know, music and the production of it and meeting the talent in person mm-hmm. from a very young age. And I think that that kind of plants a seed or something, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so interesting that you grew up with that, too. I mean, I think seeing the production side makes you aware of how the whole thing works. Mm-hmm. You know, I've worked, like, now with my family's festival, but also I've done my own little thing and kind of worked on all different sides of putting together events. And I think it makes you understand why decisions are made a certain way as an artist. And it makes you appreciate how much work other people have to do. And then also being an artist, you know, makes you... realize that you have to set up events to treat the artists with respect and not go up to them and have a bad attitude because they're putting themselves out there and being vulnerable too. We're putting ourselves out there. So I think, yeah, I mean, I think you can see all the moving pieces that it takes and it's exciting. I mean, it can be difficult at, well, oftentimes it's difficult, but, it's amazing how much you can learn by just working in the production side, I guess. Yeah, it's fun for me, too. And, like, I've worked now with my own little festival. I used to do a small one in the Bay Area, and then I stopped doing that. And I started doing this other newer one, and...
Woolly Star.
Woolly Star. Two
Love
O's,
it.
Two L's.
Two O's, two L's, everybody. Kate, two everybody. O's, two L's.
And, yeah, and it's... I think the biggest thing I'm learning now is sort of, like, I become... You know, it's sort of like a three-person team that does the event, and then we have people the week of. But I've learned a lot about how you curate a lineup. I mean, it seems easy before
no,
you do it, and it's not. Because you're also balancing the needs of the audience, their expectations, and you'd be surprised how people react to certain things. And it's like you're dealing with this balance between there's something you love, but the thing is... Is your audience going to love it? And are they going to react properly? Like, they're, you know, is it too quiet? Is it too loud? And so you're having to deal more with, like, the part of music business that I don't like as much, which is like, well, you people got to have a good time. You better make sure people have a good time, which isn't really my mentality. But I have to open my mind a little bit and be like, some people do just want to listen to just one set that's uplifting and a little lighter and a little more fun. And that's okay. Not everything has to be Leonard Cohen, you know.
I'm like, no, I want to cry in a dark corner for 12 hours straight.
I actually
do, but we're very, like, not normal festival goers.
Exactly. And I had to learn that, and also learning, like, okay, like, I just thought, like, if I want these 10 artists, like, I get them. And it's like, no, it doesn't work like that. It's hard on the booking side too at times, because you're balancing, do this band even want a tour? How much do they want for their show? Which is, you know, it's just finding where your expectations and abilities meet as the booker, as the promoter, whatever. And then also it makes me also, I think, actually have a higher standard for promoters, you know, as an artist, because it's like, I feel like if I ask somebody to play, I want to treat them really well, and I want them to have the best audience that I can manage to put together, and that's my responsibility. And not all bookers do that properly.
No, they don't.
So, yeah.
We just played a city festival, and it was just, you know... The hotel, I said, how's the festival been going? And she said, there's a festival this week. I said, oh no.
Yeah.
You know, involving the city, involving, I mean, I'm sure that that's obviously a lot of work and not my area, but I can see where, in, you know, taking into account involving local businesses and the chamber and stuff like that would, and that's probably its own full-time job, but I thought it was really interesting. The city was kind of unaware that there was
a festival. That's funny.
And I have been to so many festivals. I've been treated incredibly well and incredibly bad, and so it's, you have an advantage as an artist where you know kind of what would be awesome and what sucks. And
exactly. And I think, like, people don't realize that artists sometimes show up to a show or a venue or a festival with, like, they're just on that edge of falling apart. They've had a bad day or something's gone wrong. And if
That's every day.
I know. And it's like, as somebody who's supporting the artist, if you're putting on an event, like, you have a responsibility to not push that over the line for them. That's just not fair, because they're coming and probably, you know, for the most part, maybe going through a difficult day, or they're probably not getting compensated enough, you know, on a whole, which is just the way it goes. But I think, like, to make them feel uplifted and inspired and not feel like, you know, I don't know, disrespected or not. It's like, how is somebody supposed to go out there and perform well or have a good life if you don't give them food and water, or if you also condescend to them, or if you make them feel bad? It's like, they're already there halfway. Don't push them over the cliff of feeling bad, you know?
Wow, that's really thoughtful. And I wish everybody thought that way. There's one festival, I'm not going to say which, but there's really no space for the artists to be alone.
Yeah.
And sometimes I write in this rolling box of cardboard with five other people at least. And by the time I get somewhere, I just want to walk my dog in peace. And if I don't have 5 minutes of silence, I become this incredibly frazzled person where if someone says one thing, then I'm like, my fuse, it's like you start out with your fuse. And then if you don't get any time to regrow that fuse before you go back on stage, it's pretty, pretty tough. And sometimes you just need 5 minutes. And I just really, really love a festival that gives, like, a quiet, relaxing space, even if it's just a divider between you and the fans. You know, like, if there's no divider, that makes it really, really tough.
Yeah, that's important. You're right. It's, your fuse is short, and it's like you're already probably exhausted, and you're around a lot of people when you're showing up as a band to a gig. And it's like, if you can give somebody a little bit of space to refill their cup so that they can just, you know, be themselves and do their thing. And I'm not saying I do it perfectly every time, but I think, like, I'm just saying all this just to say that I've been on, like, a lot of different sides of how this works, and I think I've benefited from that. Not like everybody has to, but I think it's like, if promoters, bookers, venues could see it from the artist side, they would just make everything better. It would benefit them. So, yeah.
Yeah, you go away from your house for 3 weeks and tell me how you're doing. That's where I'm at right now. I even showered, and I was like, well, this is just how this is going to be today, but that's okay. I feel like you don't judge me. Thank you.
Oh, my
gosh. Just don't get too close, because it's not. So when is your festival, and what is the website? Because I'm hoping this comes out before then.
Yeah, it's June. It's Father's Day weekend this year. And it's in Markleeville, so it's about an hour from Reno. So it's about 3 hours from the Bay Area. And it's, what else is like? Oh, yeah, Woolly Star. It's got two O's and two L's, woollystar.com, nothing fancy.
Love it. Have you announced any lineups up yet?
Yeah, Tex Maniacs are playing.
I saw that.
And then there's this wonderful singer-songwriter from Nashville named Maya DeVitri that's going to play. And we're doing a little songwriter kind of round that's going to be Lucinda songs and then some people's own songs. So that's kind of what I'm doing this year. I played sets every year in the past, and I was like, I need a break. And I'm just going to sit and sing some songs, because I need a break from playing with my band thing. I need to just chill.
Well, putting on a festival and playing is... My friend Mark Powell does that. I have no idea how he does it every night. I'm like, what? Are you not exhausted? And the things that people are angry about, or the bathrooms aren't working or something. It's just so many moving parts. Oh, my gosh. And are you doing a podcast?
So it's part of the Finding Lucinda film.
Okay.
Thing. So basically what I've done is we made the film, it's been 6 years in the making, and I was like, you know, we have all these interviews, and when you make a film, it's only an hour, so each interview started at an hour long, but it's only like 5 minutes long at the end of the day. And so I was like, why can't I, there's so much more to be said. And that's the cool thing about this podcast format, is that you're not so limited by time the way you are with a lot of other forms of media. And so I was like, why don't I just take the interviews and the story from the film and just expand it? So it's pretty much overlapping with the film, but it's sort of getting deeper into it. And I've just gotten really obsessed with Lucinda's history, the history of like the music that she comes from her dad. And I think the podcast is really about the songwriting craft. How do you become a songwriter? How does your childhood influence that? And how do you also not only become a songwriter from like a technical craft sense, but also like from an emotional sense? How do you have the confidence? And this huge, well, should I tell you my biggest takeaway from this project?
Well, I was going to say, what are the answers to all of those questions? We're going to reveal them on this podcast first.
It's going
to
be 20 hours. Yeah. That'll explain
that.
And
it ends with, just be a lawyer.
That's how it ends. Yeah, I know.
Just kidding.
But no, yes, totally.
The biggest takeaway. I would be honored to hear that.
I feel like
actually, there's
so many takeaways, but the biggest takeaway that I think I got from making this project about, okay, so the question that this is answering is, I guess there's many big takeaways, but this one specific takeaway really interested me, which is I had this question because I didn't know Lucinda and I was studying her life. I was like, how did you have the confidence to make those records and get so good at making records and writing songs? Like, how did you do that? Like, so many people, I know myself included, just struggle with any sense of certainty that allows to continue doing that without stopping. And one big thing I learned was her dad was a poet, was around all these poets, and poetry is way less popular of a artistic format than songwriting, so it's like your audience is small. Even if you're the most famous poet in America, very few people even know who you are. And so I realized that when she was growing up, she grew up with a father who was a poet who had this artistic community who knew about making art for art's sake and making it incredibly well without a guarantee of making money from it or from being famous or anything. And that was a huge revelation about her life. And I'm not saying that I did or didn't have that. I didn't grow up in a super artistic family, so they were supportive, but I didn't grow up with a dad that was like, I spent 10 years writing poetry and nobody cared and I did it anyways. You know, that wasn't my experience, and that was how she grew up. She had, like, Charles Bukowski, like, these famous, famous writers, amazing writers with, you know, Flannery O'Connor in her childhood, who had to work for years on making incredible work before they got any benefits from it. And so I think that's a big takeaway that I've had. Yeah,
that's beautiful. And now I'm creating art for the sake of a minute long video or something. It's like, that's it makes me crazy. It makes me actually crazy sometimes, because it's like, oh no, we didn't need the whole song, we just needed a minute. It's like, well, that's not the whole song. What do you need a minute for? What minute do you want? And is it the first minute? And why am I even thinking in terms of a minute long? That's the attention span of America. Mm-hmm. It's not even 1 minute. So that's so beautiful. And I forget that in the rat race sometimes. And I do love songs. I have to force myself to write because I'm just, you know, I forget. And then once I have created something, I think it was Ray Riley Hubbard always thanks the source that is like, thank you for this, because it is special. And I forget how special it is so often. Until, I mean, I was just in Nashville the last few days and I saw someone do it so beautifully that it moved me. And it, you know, you forget that it can do that too, because I'm not as much moved on our cell phones. But in-person musical art is just, I don't know. It's really hard to remind myself of the why when we're having trouble, you know, paying our bills. Or no matter how much money you're getting, there's more expenses. I was telling Kyle, it's like, why don't I have any money left? I'm making good money, but it's all gone.
Yeah.
It's expensive to create our type of art and sustain it. Mm-hmm. And now I have this thing that I bought for my dog that gets 9 miles a gallon so she can come with me on the road so I don't lose my mind and the therapy that I need. It's a lot. I don't know where I was going with that.
No, we're talking about the emotional side of being an artist. And I actually think it's harder now because of what you're talking about with the pressures of promoting all the time, being like starting to overtake our mentalities and so much pressure on that. And I think you're right. And those things are important because they're the core of why we keep going or don't keep going. And that's a really interesting question to ask of, like, I was working with this producer recently and I was like, I'm, you know, working this Lucinda project. If you could ask Lucinda one thing, what would you ask? And he was like, did you ever think of stopping, you know? And we think about that all the time.
Yeah, we do.
It's like, what would I?
Yeah.
But it's just, it's a question that is an evergreen question. It's very pertinent. And I think, yeah, I mean, what you're talking about is totally understandable and reasonable things to think and talk about. And it's the real deal, you know?
And why we keep going is so we can buy dog food for the cute dog we found in the middle of the road. Aww. No, that's not it. That's not it. How'd you learn to play guitar so good, though?
Me?
Yeah.
You think I'm good at guitar?
I think you're real good at guitar.
Well, I like that. I appreciate that. I always feel like, oh, you know, I grew up, like I said, like I started playing music from bluegrass and...
We can't compare ourselves to...
Yeah, like, that, I think that's the problem is like, well, Tony Rice, right. Avery, get it together. Right. Like, yeah. Molly Tuttle, there you
Molly
go. Tuttle. Avery, you're
Molly,
nothing.
Molly, stop being so good. You're making it hard for the rest of us.
Making me look bad.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I love the expressiveness of guitar. And I think, too, it was like, maybe it was kind of a gender thing. It was like, I want to be a good guitar player. Like, mm-hmm. maybe I'm not great, but like, I want to be good because maybe I had a chip on my shoulder. I didn't want to be proven wrong or anything like that. But mm-hmm. I don't know. I still think, to me, the most exciting part of music is songwriting and lyrics and the composition and the chord structure and making records. But I love playing guitar, and I think that bluegrass background of the possibilities with cross-picking and I always get to another layer. Like, I was opening this show for this band, Watch House, is a great folk band, and I was just like, dang, like, the way they think about that one string that they play and how they hold their pick, it's like, it's infinite what you can learn.
That's amazing. And I'm just, I have a boyfriend that's really, really, really good at guitar, so it's hard for me sometimes. I'm like, you do it. Yeah, how about you just do it? And he was on the road with me for 1 week, and all the finger-picking stuff he would do, and it was just... And then the next week when I was attempting and failing mostly, but it doesn't have the same effect as a beautiful finger picking style. So I told him, I was like, I'm motivated. Once we move into our new house, I'm going to practice more guitar. And then I meet you and I was on your reels and I was like, okay, I got to get it together with the guitar. I think you're a fantastic guitar player.
Thanks.
And fantastic singer, songwriter. It's I can't wait for the Lucinda project. And that's a really interesting chapter of your life that I'm glad that you like dove into, because whenever I read about it, it's the thing that a lot of us probably have had some sort of spark of an idea that the follow through never happened. So I'm very proud of you for thinking of that and then actually taking all the steps to do it. And then the podcast and then the documentary. And now is the soundtrack your songs, or are they her songs that you're redoing? Or
yeah, so that's the plan for the soundtrack. Is there's, you know, songs that we did in the filming of the movie, and just kind of including some of those and sharing those. So it's sort of like a little bit of a tribute and a little bit of trying to understand the progress that was made, the origins of her songwriting, and like getting to see from early, like, I'm really interested in how do songwriters get better. And it's not to diminish what they did early on, but it's sort of like, I think a lot of people start in a similar place, and I'm always curious, like, how did this person get to this profound place? Because they didn't start there for the most part, almost never basically. And so the soundtrack's a little bit trying to understand her progression, but also what did she have early on, but how did she progress and develop. And the great thing about this project is just like, I've realized such a gift to dive deeper into her lyrics and still be incredibly amazed by them.
Wow.
Just how great they are,
to love her more. And yeah, that's awesome. That's beautiful.
That, she's amazing.
Wouldn't it suck if it was the opposite?
I know. I know. It's like,
you're
wait
this
a
far in. Wait. Can't go back now. No. That is gorgeous. So what do you think that it is? Mm-hmm. For me, I think I get better by quantity. Like, legit quantity has made me better.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
I agree. I think committing time and effort towards doing it in spite of other things like self-doubt or, you know, other roadblocks is incredibly important. I think that's pretty much it. I mean, if you're going to boil it down, because I think actually the better songwriter you get, the less you understand why you're doing it a certain way. Because it's sort of like, I think when I write new music, it's like, yeah, I have intentions and I edit. Not everybody edits, but I'm a big editor. But I think when I write new stuff, it's like, I'm just drawn towards what I like. And I think I embrace change. I mean, like you were saying, like you were doing that really cool dual language Spanish-English thing. And that's like embracing change, embracing something different. Or like my friend Chuck Prophet, he wrote music with a cumbia band. He was really stressed out trying to figure out how to do that. It was really hard. So it's like, I think time commitment, like you said, towards just doing it, quantity, exactly. Like when I put out a song, like I write 20 songs for every one song I put out, personally. Not finish, but like I write, because I believe in that. Yeah, that's the strategy I believe in. And maybe it's not always the best strategy, but I think it's a pretty good one.
I struggle with, sometimes I don't know what's good anymore. Mm-hmm. I say that a lot. I'll write something and I don't know if it's good or not. And that's a weird place to be. I feel like that's been really recent. That's only in like, you know, in the last couple of years. I'm like, I have no idea if this is good or not. And that's a weird feeling. But I think, I don't know, I think I might just be in some sort of phase. But I deal with imposter syndrome a lot, too, and self-doubt, too. And then I had a record where I was talking about Bart, about this with my friend Bart, where you put so much into a full-length record and you really want it to change your whole life dramatically. And if it doesn't make you, you know, super famous or go viral or whatever, then you, it's a weird feeling afterwards. And what do you, in maybe not putting so much pressure on a record for it to change your life, but instead looking at it as a beautiful piece of your life, or you at this point in time, and it's just a chapter in your book rather than a whole, I don't know. I put a lot of pressure on records and I need to cut that out.
Well, it's understandable. I think everybody does. I mean, we're always fighting that battle of like focusing on the craft versus focusing on the outcomes. I think that's like the battle of being an artist is like,
wow,
personally, but because I think the same thing too. It's like, Avery, focus on the record. You know, you read the Rick Rubin book, like, don't worry about the outcomes. It's like, it's easy to say and hard to do, but that's totally it. And I think that's really interesting what you said about not knowing. I think that's actually, that's sort of like, There's this phenomenon that happens in, like, it's called succession, ecological succession in a forest. So, like, a forest burns down. First, it's this one plant, then it's bushes, then it's trees. And I think what you're talking about with not knowing anymore if a song is good is, like, you're in the tree phase. Like, you've made it to that part of the forest, and that's just what happens. Because I feel like I'm sort of approaching that phase of like, I don't know anymore. It's funny, you'd think like, well, I've put out music and it's done some things better than I wanted, some things worse than I wanted, some things about the same. And so now it's, you'd think you get past that and you're more confident, but it doesn't work like that, weirdly.
No, it does not work like that. Or you think, is this the best, that is this the biggest my career is going to get, or is it going to get smaller or bigger? Or I love Rick Rubin's book too, but sometimes I wanted to be like, but where's the money, Rick Rubin? Focus on the art. I'd love to be in the studio more, but I got to go play the honky tonks to pay for the studio.
That's a good point.
It's brilliant. I'm obviously
True. There's a, you know, there, he's like operating on a wonderful, but sort of like a, almost like a cloud, like, plane. He's our little angel from above telling us wonderful things, and we just try to apply them in the real world.
Yeah, with his nice voice.
Yeah.
And yeah. Oh, that's awesome. And yes, it's inspiring, and we need to be constantly inspired. Anyway, I don't want to take up too much of your time. I am so glad that we met.
Me too.
Sorry when you walked in, Bart and I were in deep in a what the hell are we doing with our music career conversation, and I wanted to give you a big hug, but not interrupt his deep thought, so sorry about that.
No,
but welcome
sweat.
And I'm so glad to meet you.
Same. This is so fun.
Well, and we should do a part two sometime.
That would be great. I'll tell you what I've learned from putting out a documentary about self-doubt.
Yes. That would be, and I'm gonna be like, can't get an interview with Avery.
I don't know about that,
Kyle. Avery's definitely not coming to your dirty RV to do an interview this time.
This is a lovely spot. It's a really good RV.
Thanks. I think so too. I bought it used, and I've had it a year and a half, and I just went over 3,000 miles with almost no problems. And the one problem I did was under a grand to fix, which, like, my old Sprinter van was, you know, just no telling. I was just blowing money into the wind with that thing. And you can sleep on here. My, you know, I don't know. I like it. I think it's an option a lot of touring bands don't think of. Mm-hmm. They either think of van or bus, but there are some in-between options.
This is great. I mean, I spent, when I was living in New Mexico, I was also kind of partly living out of a truck camper, traveling around on the back of a truck. It was too small, but it brings me back to that nostalgic days of just being able to park your little tushy in some RV park that's empty and live your life.
I was in one last night walking around. Of course, my mom, are you scared? Are you going to get murdered tonight? I'm like, maybe tonight's the night, Mom. She just always thinks I'm going to get murdered. And it's delightful and very safe. And
yeah, totally.
And the stars and there was a pond. And it was after a day of driving, it was lovely. Okay, wonderful. Check out Ismay on all of the platforms. The last records were just so good. The one before that wasn't on there. I would have mentioned that one too. But the Desert Pavement was the most recent one. It's incredible. And we'll keep posted on all of your socials for the documentary.
Yeah, I'm excited to share. It's going, people.
It's, yeah. Did I miss anything?
No, you got it. Nailed it right on the head.
I don't think I did, but I didn't have time to jot down my notes, but I didn't even look at them. I think it was, the more research I did on you, the more I was like, this is going to be great and easy. You're phenomenal.
You're
Thanks for
awesome.
Being here. Congrats.
Muchas gracias.
De nada. Nailed it.
Where's the accordion?
Beginning with daylight, stars as I open my eyes. I'm a soft white, and my room feels cold and dry. I walk from the house to the barn that sits down by the brook. Find old beer through, see a jacket there on a hook. In front of me, on hay, he sleeps. I've gotta go.